Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. Then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk.
Happy Shabbat to everyone. We're here with Lisa today, with Captain Kirk, and with James, JB. How are you guys?
Fine, thank
you. Doing good.
Well, good. As I said on the observation
before we get
show,
going,
today,
can I make a technical note?
Sure.
I've had a couple of emails from people saying they called in wanting to talk, but we never put them on. The way the screening software works, it doesn't it just puts everyone into a big list, even if you're listening. But if you'll press 1 after you can hear the show, it will move your name, your number, to the top of my list, so I'll see it and mark it, letting me know that you want to call. So do that, and I'll screen the call and put you on.
Okay. Thank you, JB. As I said earlier, most of us are living now in a realm that global warming forgot. We are down about 7 degrees here in Ohio, and I understand that's warm compared to folks in Minnesota. Scott today said it was minus 11.
Yeah.
You know, you can't even walk around inside of your house without a jacket, and at times you think about, well, gloves would be nice about now.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's I'm one of those that said if global warming is a reality, bring it on.
Yeah.
I think we need more of it.
And
that's what people don't realize. Global warming ain't a threat. When the planet warms, plants grow more. That's a good thing.
Oh, I know.
Global
cooling's
a threat.
Yeah, without exceptions, man's most difficult times have been during periods of global cooling. And, you know, since they occur every on cycles every 500 to 600 years, we have a warming cycle followed by a cooling cycle. That means about 1,000 to 1,200 years, you'd go through the entire cycle from warm to cool, back to warm again. If you look at the past 5 to 6,000 years, recorded history began just about 6,000 years ago, right when Yahweh said it would. And while mankind has been around a lot longer than that, Nesalma man, a man with a conscience, with an ability to think, being able to create what is the greatest invention in human history. It's not the wheel, it's not fire, it's a written alphabet, an ability to write down words and to communicate in written form. And that began just shy of 6,000 years ago. And you know, as you study history, one of the things that you find is that we can track these global warming and cooling periods. And during the warming periods, civilization thrived. And during the cooling periods is when we had the worst of times. You know, for example, the Black Death, that occurred during a cooling period, you know, a time when crops did not grow well, people were malnourished, and the plague which is still prevalent on the planet. It had been on the planet for many thousands of years before it devastated so many lives. It was effective because of two things. One was that people were malnourished and therefore in poor health, so they were more susceptible to the plague, and that's why so many died. And that was because of the cooling period that hurt crop production. But it's also because mankind was overtly religious. And being religious, they were not rational, and not only were incapable of doing the proper things to mitigate the damage from the pestilence, they actually encouraged more of it because of the stupidity of religion during those periods. But nonetheless, we are certainly freezing here now. Kirk, you and I spoke a lot about daily events and emailers' questions during their observation show. So I thought maybe, unless somebody has something in particular they wanted to discuss, we could go directly to Yeshaya and pick up towards the end of the second chapter.
Okay.
Do you have anything to add to what we were discussing in observations? We talked a lot about what was the timing of the Exodus from Brad, specifically mentioning it probably had to be 1467, 1468 BCE to be a Yobel year. I don't think there's any chance it wasn't a Yobel year. I think he's right. And then we talked a lot about Yahweh's return, what he is going to be like when he dials down his energy sum. He has to actually dial it down a considerable amount because, as I said, say, seven-dimensional constructs can't enter a six-dimensional realm. They're incapable of doing so. So he still has to dial down his nature to be able to live with us here for a 1,000 years.
And then also we covered a little bit of John, who was did a lot of research on Tarshish and where it was originally. Originally been before it became Carthaginian, basically. So,
there's two Tarshishes. The Tarshish that is the primary metaphor for this Yeshaya line that came about five or six statements earlier than 218, which is where we're going to pick up, specifically says that after Yahweh condemns politicians, condemns religious leaders, condemns military leaders, and economic leaders, he says that he is against Tarshish and the cargo that those ships carry that is considered to be so valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And after research, both you and I, Kirk, came to the conclusion that it's pretty easy to figure out who Tarshish was and who it applies to, because I was speaking of year 2033, year 6000 Yah, and there was
one candidate.
Only one candidate that matches the depiction of the Tarshish circa 745 CE, which was Carthage, and the fact that they had the de facto reserve currency of the world, that they built the largest empire of the time, the same way the United States has done primarily through military bases very different than the Roman strategy of occupation. It was an economic empire, just as the United States has created an economic empire. And the United States, of course, has the only reserve currency in the world. And they were the de facto superpower economically during their time. And so the Tarshish specifically related to ships and trading the United States, and that's what he's referring to. But John also wanted to bring out the fact, and we mentioned it when we covered that passage, that Tarshish is also the name of the city in central Turkey today, Asia Minor back then, that Paul, the founder of Christianity, hailed from. And so when Yahweh says, I'm against it, he's also alluding to Christianity, although it can't be the primary symbol for Tarshish, and that Jonah sailed from Jaffa to Tarshish and you really can't sail to the center of what is today present day Turkey. So,
but all things being, he leaves you so many trails to grab another extra meaning is rather fabulous.
Yeah, and I don't think there was any chance that Tarshish, God could have chosen to identify the country and economy that he was opposed to in Yeshaya 2, as he did in Yeshaya 18, where in Yeshaya 18 he uses some 12 or 13 different words that describe a single country, the United States. Now, that took 10 sentences to do that. And he doesn't want to break up the flow of what he is communicating here, where he is now denouncing politics, militarism, elitist economics, and mostly religion. He didn't want to break it up by putting that same amount of information in, so he used Tarshish as the reference and allowed us to figure it out, because it was clear why Yahweh would tie Tarshish to it circa 745 BCE. They were overtly religious, overtly political, overtly militaristic, and they fit the metaphor perfectly. They had a monopoly on metal trading and a monopoly on currency, and their navy was dominant, and they were a ruthless group of thugs as a country. So it fit then. It fits now, and it also fit in between with Paul. So
it
marvelous.
That's probably what God just called America. I mean, my gosh.
Yeah.
Before you move on from Carthage, the thing about the Carthage society that most people are unaware of was the fact that they burned their children.
Uh-huh.
And who gave the world Roe versus Wade?
You know,
and the right to abort your child.
Yeah, a couple of things to keep in mind, though, just to be in fairness here. And I guess there's really no reason to be fair when people are burning children alive. When I came across the line as I was studying henna, which we're going to come to in a later chapter of observations, when Yishak asked his father, I see the fire. I see the wood. Where is the lamb for the offering? And because we're already of the mindset, okay, Passover, there's, of course, a lamb for Passover. So, he's just asking about the Passover lamb. I said, whoa, wait a minute. We are 440 years or more from the Exodus. There's been no talk about Passover. The Torah, teaching may have gone verbally to these guys, but Yahweh wouldn't reveal the Torah in a written form until Moshe, nearly 500 years later. So why is he talking about a lamb? I said, okay, there's only two options here. One is that Yahweh specifically had Yishak and Jacob, son and father, celebrating Pesach because he told them about them. And therefore, they knew they were going up to celebrate Pesach. Or there were cultures around the world, particularly in that region, that used animals, particularly lambs, as a means of reconciling their relationship with God. One of those two things was true. So what I did is I spent about a day and a half, and I searched sacrifices, religious sacrifices, animal sacrifices, at the ancient world. And I went through every culture that I could find, and I read everything I could find on the sacrifices of the ancient world. And you know what I found? Was the dominant sacrifice of the ancient world?
Humans.
Humans. Yeah, and particularly children, but humans. And particularly the only place that was really relevant to this was Ur. And, sometimes you just... amazing how things fall into place. It was just recently, only within the last 5 years, that archaeologists have unearthed in Ur mass graves of tens of thousands of men, women, and children, all who were killed at the same time, all who were killed the same way, having a spike driven through their heads, all of which were smeared in mercury, all of which were baked to preserve the flesh to keep it from, you know, rotting and stinking so they could be put on display, all that were buried, Dibley, after all of that, in the backyard of a palace.
Mm.
And so what it demonstrates is that Ur, which is where Abraham came from, that would have been his culture, that there were mass murders as part of religious ceremonies, and that thousands of people were murdered and then paraded through the streets on these religious holidays. And so now I'm dealing with, okay, Yishak says, where's the lamb? Do you know, as I went from Ur, which is the capital of Sumer, to Babylon, to Assyria, to Persia, to Egypt, to Greece, to the Carthaginian Empire, which you've already mentioned, to early Rome. Do you know that even in early Rome and Greece, and also in Egypt, human sacrifice was common? And then, of course, you come to the New World. You mentioned, why not just say America? The Incas and the Aztecs and the Mayas, the centerpiece of their religious celebrations were the sacrifice of humans. Even in Hawaii, with the Polynesians, tens of
the American Indians
of human sacrifices. Yeah. Yeah, and the more brutal the sacrifice to the god, the better. They would typically, in the Americas and in the Pacific, they would open up the chest of the victim while they were alive, being held down, and literally pull out their heart. I mean, imagine that.
Just play it to the
ground.
And
that was part of a religious ceremony to their god. So in a world that was sacrificing humans and doing so in the most ruthless way, I could not find a single civilization whose celebration with their divinity was to have a feast and to sacrifice an animal whose flesh provided the food for that feast. So they're not being sacrificed and given to the gods. They're not being sacrificed as an offering to the gods. They're being sacrificed as part of the meal to celebrate. There wasn't one.
Even really a sacrifice. You know, sacrifice implies giving up something. They're not. You don't give up anything on Passover. You cook
nothing.
The lamb. I gave up the
you
bone.
The lamb.
Yes.
You
ate the
lamb.
Anyways.
Right.
Gave up
the difference between...
There wasn't a single culture in the world. Not one.
No. The difference between the Mesopotamian culture of sacrifice being a human, which was the standard.
Mm-hmm.
And what Yahweh's plan is that the sacrifices that humans make are for the gods. And if
correct.
If you listen to some of the cuneiform tablets and their little stories, it will tell you the gods came around our sacrifice like flies. You know,
mm-hmm.
It was somehow for them, food for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh's providing
correct.
Us the food.
Yeah, that's
it's
why
it's the
so,
other way around. It's
yeah,
the
father
that he's one. He's the only. He's the God that's given, making a sacrifice of himself
correct.
For his own child
correct.
That he created for
right.
us, versus we killing our children for the God. I mean, that's
yeah.
a 180 degree turn.
Every piece of food you put in your mouth, Yahweh's creation, all of it.
Right, but it was one of those awakening moments where you said, "All right, well, what that proves is what Yahweh said later." That I shared my Torah, my teaching with Abraham. If he had not done so, and he had not communicated that then from Abraham to Yishak, he would never have said, "Where's the lamb?" And yet, you read that through, and no one ever takes a moment to think about it. But what did it mean? The thing that really upset me is that a lot of irrational scholars condemn the Torah and the God of the Torah because of animal sacrifices. You know, we've gone beyond that now. We don't need to do animal sacrifices. Well, if you eat protein, And I understand there are some forms of protein that aren't animal, but they're few and far between.
And they ain't the good ones.
If you're a carnivore or an omnivore, you're eating protein. And if you're eating protein, you know, as a scholar, if you're having a steak or chicken or turkey or whatever it is that you prefer to eat, that animal sacrificed its life to nourish you and your family. So as you say, it really isn't a sacrifice. It should never have been presented using the term sacrifice. And we do ourselves a real disservice when we realize that we don't realize that it's true, that Yahweh made the sacrifice, so we would have to, and that all of this is to show his role. You know, he became the Passover lamb.
Now, think about it. You know, a sacrifice means giving up something to gain something. What do you give up to be in Yahweh's, you know, in a relationship with Yahweh? He asks you to give up religion, and he asks you to give up politics.
That's a net gain.
Yeah.
That's a net gain. That's a net gain.
But giving those up isn't, you know, a bad thing even. It isn't. Once you do it, you realize how freeing it is.
Correct.
You know, it's like, oh,
yeah,
you're not giving anything up at that point.
Right. He asks you to walk to him and become perfected. That's a net gain. He asks you to trust and rely upon him. That's a net gain. And he asks us to circumcise our sons on the eighth day. So that
we remember him,
and so that there's our sign that we are committed to the covenant. From a health point of view, that's also a benefit.
So basically, you give up some useless skin that is actually does more harm than good.
Right, by design.
Yeah.
By design. We're designed that way. We're designed to have the net result of everything Yahweh asks of us be a benefit.
Yeah.
Let me ask a question.
All right.
Okay.
Sure.
He goes. Abraham goes up the hill. He knows about the. Obviously, he taught Yishak about the lamb, or he never would ask the question. So he obviously
Correct.
Knows what the sacrifice should be. But he goes up with knife in hand, ties him up, and puts him on the thing. Does at that point does he not know for sure whether he's going to have to
do this? No, he knew for sure. He
okay,
knew for then, absolute certain that he was not taking the life of his son.
Okay.
Yahweh already told him and also Jacob that
he's doing that
exactly,
for our,
the, our
the covenant
understanding,
would, right?
would grow through them. That therefore,
well, it's kind of like
Yishak
when,
was going to have a
you
son.
Know, Yahweh said he was going to kill everyone in Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abram
right.
went to Yahweh, and you know, if there's one righteous man, he knew God wasn't going to do it. You know, and it's the same thing there. He's like, okay, God's having me do this for a reason. I may not understand that reason yet, but he's having me do it for a reason. I know he's not going to make me kill my son, I'm going to go anyway.
The whole experience was a test.
Mm-hmm.
Whole experience. Yahweh uses the word test. We're going to get to it. In fact, we're going to spend months on it, because it's two chapters, two very long chapters, 200 pages on the test. The whole experience in going to Moriah was a test. Yahweh wanted to test Abraham. Now, a test is not a bad thing. You know, sometimes you say test and that's a pejorative. No, it's an opportunity to demonstrate that you understand and that you know the right answer. That's a test.
Hey, Craig, do you think they'd let you fly a plane if you didn't have a test?
Oh, no. Yeah, I had to pass a whole lot of tests to be able to make both written tests and practical tests and oral tests and flight tests. And to even be insured in my plane, I have to pass tests.
They test your vision, too? They must have tested that.
Yeah, they test my vision. Absolutely.
They,
I have to have a physical test to qualify to fly an airplane. Tests are appropriate. We have to pass a test to drive our cars. So anyway, tests are important things. But anyway, Yahweh wanted to test Abraham to see if he had the correct answer, because he was offering him an eternal covenant relationship. And so Abraham was told that this was a test and that he was being asked to provide the correct answer. And the correct answer is, listen to what Yahweh has to say, act upon his instructions, trust and rely on him relative to all of these things. And that if you do that, then Yahweh will accept that as the right answer. So when he went, he knew that the right answer was to listen to what Yahweh says and do what he says, and that everything will work out beautifully. So he knew he wasn't going to kill his son. He knew there was a 0%. There is no right answer that says kill your son.
No,
but there's a right answer that says listen to what Yahweh has to say, go where he asks you to go, and act as he asks, respond as he requests. Trust him. Those are all right answers.
Yeah. Well, he certainly has a right to test him.
Absolutely. Don't, you know, if I have to take a test, as Lisa said, to fly an airplane, don't you think that Yahweh would want to provide a test to determine who gets to spend all eternity in heaven? Specifically, because of the fact
power.
That
yes,
we are
so.
Going
Look,
to be able to fly much faster than my airplane
will
ever
me,
go.
Because I can't stand some people.
Right. But it's that, and we're going to be empowered such that we can literally create suns, that we can literally create solar systems and galaxies.
Black holes.
And life.
That's a bit damaging
and,
if you don't know what you're doing.
You think if we showed an unwillingness to listen to Yahweh's instructions, to act upon them, and an unwillingness to trust and rely on him, we would not be safe around a black hole. We wouldn't be safe with the power, nor would anybody else be safe with the power we're giving. So Yahweh has to test all of us. The test is always the same. Are you willing to listen to what he has to say? Do you understand what he is communicating? Are you willing to accept it? Will you trust and rely upon it? Will you go and do what he asks you to go and do? The Torah is directions and guidance, after all. The answer is yes. That's the correct answer on all of those things. Welcome. Welcome to the covenant. And this was a teaching moment for Abraham and for Yitzhak, because when Abraham did everything that Yahweh said, Yahweh intervened and said, no, you're not going to take the life of your son. That's my job. I'm going to provide the sacrifice. I'm just here so that you can tangibly demonstrate what I'm going to do in exactly 40 Yobel. That's the correct answer to this test, that Yahweh provided the sacrifice, that he did exactly what he said he was going to do, and the whole story of Abraham and Yitzhak walking to Mount Moriah was simply to explain, for Yahweh to reveal in a very tangible way with the two most important people on earth precisely what he was going to do for the covenant family. And I don't think there's one person in a million that looks at the story of Abraham and Yitzhak that way. But that is the story. Now, returning to Yeshayah, Isaiah 128 is about where we left off. Oh, excuse me, 218 is where we about where we left off.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, put in context, Yahweh has said, "I am opposed to every form of government, judicial and military and economic." Leader, and especially religious leaders. I am overtly opposed to religion, and that is what I'm going to judge, that is what I'm going to condemn when I returned. And then he says, and the artifacts of worship, the ineffectual ideas, the worthless idols, and the false gods, this is wa'al'il, then the religious imagery, the idolatrous exhortations and reverence, the ineffective shepherds, the good-for-nothing notions. It's from all, that which above all the gates and leads to nothingness, shall utterly and completely, kalil, totally and absolutely, entirely to perfect, go away, be removed, be discarded and vanished, and vanish. This is chalak. Will be rejected, cast off, and abolished. Now, religious ideals, artifacts of religious worship, and the ineffectual ideas that drive them are found in many forms. There's temples and shrines, tombs, the pyramids, for example, the Parthenon, for example, the Vatican and St. Peter's, for example, the National Cathedral in America, for example, the Mormon temple in Salt Lake City and around the various smaller temples around the country, the Blue Mosque that turned Constantinople's church into a mosque. Yeah. All of those things are artifacts, the Colosseum in Rome. Those are religious artifacts. And, you know, don't think of the Colosseum as a
sporting
arena to for sports. It wasn't.
Still a shrine
yeah,
of death.
A shrine of death for a death cult, a religion of militarism, a religion of superiority, a religion of conquering people, and of course the gods were their gods were all paraded through that facility. All of those things are going
to
be destroyed. Beyond the destruction of those things, the all of the religious emblems, like for example, if you have a cross tattoo, a Star of David tattoo, you probably want to get rid of it. If you have a religious artifact in your home, and you know, if you're still around, I don't want to listen to this program. It will be here on 2020. Well, we'll be here, but we'll be spirit based at that point. But you don't want to have any religious artifact in your home. You don't want to have them anywhere. Now, the other thing that this would include is Bibles. You know, Bibles are filled with first the title Babel. That's the Hebrew word for confusion, for commingling the truth and lies. Filled with 13 letters from Paul, the plague of death. They will all be destroyed. But God has been pretty clear about this whole thing, that yeah, there are religious artifacts, and he's clearly going to destroy them. They're going to be discarded. They're going to vanish. So all traces of religion will vanish. But the primary repository for religion has never been churches.
The human mind.
Or temples. That is correct.
Mm-hmm.
The human mind, the human heart, the human soul. And that's where those ineffectual ideas take root.
You know, we were talking
earlier
about the whole human sacrifice thing, and it got me thinking, you know, take the two biggest religions in the world today, Islam and Christianity. Well, Islam, it's obvious where the human sacrifice comes in. It's in their, you know, suicide bombers,
yeah.
You know, the greatest thing
correct.
You can do for, you know, Allah. But look at Christianity and Catholicism, especially in their obsession with the saints and the martyrs.
Right. Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's the
John
same
Fox's,
principle.
John Fox's Book of Martyrs, when most of that was contrived. But
mm-hmm.
they want martyrs. I mean, how many religions do you know?
They want you
that
willing
have,
to go
that
kill
parade
yourself
around a
and
dead
die
god.
For your
we
religion.
We talked about this. Yeah, we talked about this at length this afternoon. Christianity is baby god and dead god.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
God on a stick.
Yeah, that's
dead
their
god
two
god
favorite
stick.
Images.
No, which
yeah.
religion, like Babylon,
man on a cross.
Right.
Like Babylon of old, which religion still dresses up their dead people, buries them under the pulpits, and parades them around the streets with flowers and processions? Catholics.
Yeah,
of course.
They have an entire
yeah.
church over in Europe made completely out of bones of dead people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
oh, in the catacombs. They look at those and, you
mm-hmm.
know, they're...
Catacombs, yeah.
Yeah, it is pretty astonishing.
Religion loves
death. But understand that child sacrifice is a horrible thing. And, you know, America's acceptance of abortion was a terrible thing. But, you know, the thing I was going to be careful on abortion is, do you know that the rate of abortion in countries that have it legal and countries that where it is illegal is exactly the same?
Oh, yeah. Making abortion
the whole
illegal
world
will do absolutely nothing to decrease
correct.
The amount of abortions.
Correct. No, Roe v. Wade didn't increase the number of abortions, and it did not decrease the number of abortions. The statistics worldwide have been the same now for as long as we have kept even known about such things. The rate of abortion is the same in countries where it is legal or illegal, because the nature of humans, of women who are would otherwise be mothers, is that life is an inconvenience. Kill it.
Yeah.
That
the only way to fix that issue is educating people and, you know, making it where they feel bad about doing it, and then, like you said, actually legitimately fixing people, which there's only one way to
well,
do
yeah.
that. And that's
well, you're not. You can't do
company.
That in the Islamic world, because in the Islamic world,
yeah.
A, the woman has no value, and B, it isn't a religion that values life; it's a religion that values death. And and the Christianity, there are the religion is so hypocritical. The religion is so obviously untrue. And in Pauline Christianity, women have no value. It is you're lied to so many ways. It's very difficult to reason with someone who has to accept the religion on faith, because it is obviously false when considered rationally. But those are not the ways I don't think is most concerned. You know, the Christians that parade out in front of Planned Parenthood and consider abortion killing, you're not going to see me do that, because there is a far more deadly plague. There's something that's infinitely more deadly than is the killing of unborn fetuses through abortion. You know what that is?
Christianity.
Yeah.
Religion.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, religion as a whole.
And
the most deadly
macabre,
of all.
Example, go to, I'm telling you, go to Czech Republic. I saw the Church of Bones. I've never seen anything in my life that affected me in such a way. And I've been to very poor countries and hate
people. Yeah, the worst I ever saw. I tell you, the two things that had the greatest effect on me. And there's something worse than a Church of Bones. First is walking into Auschwitz and seeing the mountain.
I've never done that.
The mountain, literally a mountain, a large hill, if you will, of cremated bones. And then walking into a room that is piled with tens of thousands of shoes, many from little bitty feet,
mm-hmm.
and you realize that was a factory to mass murder people, and those are the bones of those people outside of that factory. And the only thing, and it was related, that caused me to just say my whole worldview, I cannot process this in my worldview, is when it's the one part of my tour in Israel that really drove right to my core. And that is, there's a Holocaust museum in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, God, I can't even talk about it without tearing up. There's a room that you walk into. It's the second large chamber, and the whole place is dark. And in that room, there are 1 million little lights. They represent the 1 million 1- and 2-year-olds the Nazis murdered. 1 million 1- and 2-year-old children. It's just hard to fathom how disgusting humanity can be.
I think.
And so. That's right. The most deadly thing in the world is religion. That's why Yahweh says that fathers corrupt their children to the third and fourth generation, fourth and fifth generations, that there's nothing deadlier than religion. And so those who are out there with their families protesting Planned Parenthood are far more deadly than those inside that are participating in abortions.
I think it should be mandatory that people see all those British films when they went into Auschwitz and they piled up the bodies, and that blew me away when I was young and saw all those things. I don't know if they still show them anymore because of political correctness, but those things were absolutely, they're all black and white film, but my God, it was all the evidence in the world.
Yeah, when I was, back in the day I was a Christian, I had the opportunity to meet Corey Tinboom, who was a child of the Holocaust. She was in the Holocaust, lost her mother and her sisters. And she tells the story. She wrote a book about her experiences and in the Holocaust. And, you know, meeting someone who actually survived it was... and I've had customers when I was in sales. I mean, all my best customers were Jewish. And one of my customers had the had a tattoo, you know, that was put on his wrist, which was common for the Jews who were committed to the death camps.
Inventoried
in the death camps. They wore their SKU number, their UPC code. So the artifacts of worship and the ineffectual ideas shall utterly and completely be discarded and vanished. They shall go away and be removed. The prior to translating this verse, I had shared with anyone who would listen my conclusion based upon Yahweh's testimony by making the connections and going from knowing to understanding that the story of Eden is told to us because that is where we are returning. We are going right back to Eden. The millennial Shabbat, this thousand-year celebration of Sukkah, is a thousand-year return to the time of Eden, the Garden of Great Joy, and where God and man camped out together. It was so obvious to me, but to do that, what God has to do is he has to transform the entire earth back to the conditions of Eden. Was there a church in Eden?
No, sir.
No.
Nope.
Was there a mosque? A shrine?
Nope.
A temple?
Likely.
Was there
preachers,
a capital
rabbis,
building,
or imams?
A Congress, a Senate, a White House?
Nope.
Was there a monastery? Was there a fortress?
There wasn't even
a habitat. Was there a courthouse? Was there a courthouse?
Nope.
No, sir.
No. God's going to bring the earth back into conditions where there's no politics, no religion, and no militarism. So what he has to do is he has to wipe all of that from the face of the earth. All weapons. That's why he said that they will transform their weapons into tools that will be used to harvest food.
Now, if Hezekiah,
and they will never speak
that,
of war again.
If Hezekiah got that, why wouldn't every Christian that read that story?
I don't know. You know, it's but.
I mean, that's exactly what it is.
I don't think there's one in a million people, Kirk, that have figured out that the story of Eden is presented because we're going to return to the place it all began. And but here Yahweh is telling us, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to remove all of this rubbish from the earth so the entire earth becomes like Eden. It's so obvious.
Well,
it's so clear.
Way to read it.
Right. Which means we're right back to a simple relationship, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
No religion.
Ah, yes, we come back to the Aleph.
Yeah, it's really simple relationship. So it says, and from the appearance of their dread of Yahweh, they shall go into the caves and the wastelands of rocks and into the holes of the grounds, and all of the overwhelming, impressive splendor of his majesty in his stand to inspire the land from this. So you have two options here. Either Yahweh is giving personification to religious ideals and religious idolatry, religious imagery, and he's saying, listen, these things are going to feel dread. Or he is speaking of those who convey these religious notions.
Yeah, dread. It has to be people, right?
That they will be feel the dread of Yahweh. But it is interesting that those ideas that are supposedly godly, you know, the religious notions that if you attack Christianity, you're considered as satanic and ungodly. What God is saying is that that the religious ideas are actually so opposed to God that the real God they would dread. It's exactly what we find. You know, you asked a question last week that had been bouncing around in the various forums and discussion mm-hmm. groups that we have about why is it that most people reject Yahweh's testimony. Well, it's because they don't like Yahweh. They don't like what he had to say. And in fact, they get angry. There's a sense of dread. It's like chemistry professor I talked to a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
The truth was that, yeah, I don't think I can process this. No. I mean, there's a universal disdain for the God of the Torah.
Oh, yes, I met one of those this week, a Christian scientist. What an oxymoron.
Yes.
How do you deal with these people?
Yeah,
this man
like
was
show,
smart,
no.
yet completely irrational.
Yeah. And so it tells us what we have already come to recognize, that it's not just that religions create a false god and are filled with irrational and invalid promises. When the real God and his testimony is exposed, they hate him.
Yeah. Well, he used the same word that he used when he described the contempt that Hasatan had when he was talking to Chawa. Alf. Oh,
yes, exactly. Yeah, we're going to get to that in a moment.
It's just a hostile intent.
Right.
It's just a
right.
spewing hatred. Yeah,
it is an imbuing hatred.
That was my real question. I understand people rejecting Yahweh. I mean, you can reject a lot of things for a lot of reasons, I guess. But why so much hostility when you?
Yeah.
When
oh, they hate
a different view.
Hate, absolutely hate what he has to say. Now, there's a reason to view some of this symbolically. They are not going to go into caves. They're not going to go into holes in the ground. That's symbolic.
It'd be a black hole, though.
Yeah, yeah. But a cave could be, you know, that's a lightless place.
Mm-hmm.
So into a depression, such as so it's a depression. It speaks of dust. It speaks of small particles. And so darkness and compressed small particles does. Again, fit the black hole symbolism for Sheol. I'm not saying Sheol is a black hole. I'm just saying that the closest thing we have to explain what is being described here would be a black hole. That's so into holes. Now, these are holes in the ground, but they're holes where things are become very fine and there's depressed the smallest particle of material. And he says, I'm doing this because of his stand to inspire the land. So what God is saying is, I am either willing or able to inspire those in the land of Yisrael while there is the Dome of the Hoofy Print, the mosque on the Temple Mount, the church of the tomb, whatever they call the Holy Sepulchre,
Holy Sepulchre.
That while that stuff exists there, I can't go there. I'm not. Well, there's all that stuff. I'm incapable or unwilling to inspire those in the land to reveal myself as I actually am, to be pitted and revered. I can't do that while those things exist. I can't or I won't. Now, I'm not sure if it's can't or won't, but that's what he's saying here. It's that these things have to happen for him to
I can't
be able to take a stand. Yeah. Yeah, I can't and I won't. Then he, and by the way, the reason he can't, and people have a conniption fit again when you try to ascribe things to God that he can't do, but there are a ton of things that God can't do.
Oh,
for example, he can't do the things that Christians see the their God as an all meddling, all involved, omnipresent God who hears every little prayer. Yeah, micromanager. Yeah, that's how they see their God. Well, God can't be that. He can't be everywhere.
God can't,
he can't listen to everyone's prayer. He can't intervene in free will. If he does any of those things, he ceases to be fair.
He can't lie.
No, he can't lie.
Can't go against his word either.
No, he can't go into hell, Sheol.
Right.
His soul can go there for a limited period of time to fulfill matzah, but he can't stay. You can't kill him. God can't die. God can't be born. A lot of things God can't do, and one of the things he cannot do is inspire Yisrael until such time as all of the religious trappings in Yisrael are gone. He is not going to compete with religion. And the reason is that he can't compete with religion so long as free will exists. And he won't compete with religion once we're all part of his family, because it's just a miserable thing. There's no reason for Yahweh to compete. There's no reason to put any of us under that, in that kind of an environment where there is competition with the lies of religion. I don't want to hear it. He doesn't want to hear it. But between now and then, he would infringe on free will. He would have to act in ways that he is uncomfortable and unwilling to do to compete against religion. He's just not going to do it.
Well, that was his first statement in stone.
Correct.
He should not exist with other gods in the relationship to me. I'm not going to have it. I'm not going to be in the presence with them, so period.
Right, so period. Yeah. I'm not going to compete with them.
No.
And that's reasonable. I've had lots of people try to pick a fight with me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to compete with you. People try to debate me. Why? There's no purpose in it, nothing to be gained. No, I'm just not going to do it. In that specific day, his day, another reference to his day, this is Yom Kippurim, he will throw away human objects of worship, their ineffectual religious ideals, their money, and their worthless idols and false gods of gold, which they made for themselves to provide explanations, pontificating, using words while bowing down in worship, tossing them to the rodents, the dung beetles, and the moles, as well as to the bats. All right, so he's once again talking about the Ayil, the objects of worship, the ineffectual religious ideas. But this time, there's something else that he's associating with it, and that's money. How many people think that they're impressing their God when they make a donation? How many people think they're going to get a blessing from God if they dig deep and donate? Christianity runs on this.
Christian preachers
on
the TV, hold up your hand, you'll get a blessing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How many billions do those guys make? Gosh.
Oh, I know. So God is saying that not only don't I want your money, money is going to be destroyed. I've got no use for it whatsoever. But he's associating religion and money. And then he's saying, I don't want any part of it. The Vatican's in trouble here. Their money or their worthless idols and false gods of gold, which they have made for themselves, What do they make them for? To provide explanations, pontifications, words, bowing down in worship. How many Roman Catholics bow down in front of their gleaming gold crucifix in front of those churches? They're God on
all of
them. All of them.
Yeah, how many of them bow down to the little statue of Mary as you walk in to their cathedral?
Same, yeah.
Exactly. Mm. He says he's going to toss them to the rodents, dung beetles, and moles, as well as to the bats. Again, symbols. Now, you know, the dung beetles and bats to have an appetite for money and for gold. He says, you know, that dung beetles and rodents and moles.
Rats will eat pretty much anything.
Yeah, and bats, you know, they're all rodents. I mean, except the dung beetle. But, you know,
the dung beetle pushes bullshit.
I know,
I think the dung beetle is the single most likely.
And the moles are blind. That's the religious people.
moles are blind.
Good point. Good
dung
point.
Beetles, yeah, that's very good. They push dung. BS.
And the bats going about eating up other things. That's the military.
Yeah.
There you go.
Oh yeah, and
yeah,
the bats, of course, carry disease.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
They're black. They fly around at night carrying disease.
Let me ask you a quick question about translating that little
military
thing. You have Lachawa. And the Masoretic, all I could find was what I had translated with Shakar, which is to revere or to pose, to bow down. But that was a different word. It was,
Chawa, has a primary meaning, and the primary meaning is to verbally announce, displaying with speech, informing. And then its secondary meaning speaks of prostration. So, and when it's applied,
is it like
to,
in
you
the
know,
Dead Sea Scrolls, when it's not in the Masoretic? Because on two lexicons, two interlinearies, I couldn't find it, and it just drove me crazy.
Yeah, you know what? One of the things that's always interesting about this is that there are lexicons that only have Chawa as to verbally announce, to display. And there's others that have Chawa as to bow down. In fact, I did about 5 or 6 pages of just analysis of what every lexicon has regarding this word and the history of the word and its relationship to the wife of Adam, Chawa.
Mm-hmm.
What the word means when Yahweh uses it in a variety of different places. So,
okay, so I'm not going crazy
because
I couldn't find any one of them, two of the lexicons, right? I mean, two of the, it drove me. Just saying, well, what am I missing? Okay.
Yeah. So, Chawa is a really interesting term, though. It means to communicate, use words to inform. Yeah, to declare, to announce, to explain. And so, in this case, it is these religious ideas that are being used to provide explanations for things. You know, what's going to happen after your death? Well, little Joey went to heaven to be with God. If the cross is God dying for you, you know, the God on a stick. So these things are all used to explain the nature of the religion, and that's what God is going to toss away.
Allah says, if you kill the Jews, you get an easy way in. There you go.
That's right. Yeah. But in the case of Adab Ayil, human objects of worship, set into that context, Chawa would be an unforgivable offense. It means that the cleric is making pronouncements on behalf of their idols, declaring their support for false gods, while pontificating ineffectual ideas, which compel the foolish to into Chawa's secondary connotation, which is to bow down and worship, showing religious devotion by prostrating oneself in homage to a deity. Then he says, therefore, they will enter into the rocks and thus be securely confined for being adversarial, going into fissures of volcanic stone from and before the presence of their dread of Yahuwah, and from the overwhelming, impressive splendor of his majesty in his stand to inspire the land. Once again, God's speaking symbolically, but he's saying that until those things are pulverized back to dust, completely out of sight, they were so adversarial. And until the hosts of those things are confined in such a way that they can no longer harass humankind, that the impressive majesty and splendor of Yahuwah cannot be on this earth. He's not going to coexist with those things. So they're going into the, you know, symbolically, to the fissures of the earth, to the clefts of the fractures of hardened magma. And it's because they are so adversarial to Yahuwah. And he is not going to take his stand to inspire, to prevail, to be seen as majestic in the land until such time as they're gone. Right. And so he's personally going to deal with them.
Before we move on, I would like to point out that the word used was Adam Alil, and that is things that we, idols, we've made with our own hands.
Correct. So yeah, what kind of an idol is there that we haven't made with our own hands?
Yeah.
That's right. That's
money. We worship
we've
money.
Done
we've
done this.
We made the money. You know, those God on a stick crosses, all that sort of
made
thing.
That too.
We made those as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we make our idols. You know, when we elect politicians and they become, you know, people almost revere their political leaders. You go in with your hand and you cast your vote. You don't cast your vote with your mouth. You cast your vote with your hand. You know, when you make idols of people in Hollywood.
Movie stars are idols.
Putting your hand in your pocket, reaching into your purse or billfold and pulling out money and handing it to the cash register, giving them a credit card. You know, you're turning them into idols with your hand. Idols that we've made.
Well, heck, was one of the most popular TV shows in America for the last decade? American Idol?
Oh. Yeah, American Idol.
Yeah,
people
more people vote for
their
American Idol than the U.S.
Right.
president.
Right, you would dial up, you know, push your finger on the phone. You would dial in the phone to create your vote for the idol. Yeah, idols that we have made with our hands. You should refrain from approaching, and you should forsake, staying away from the provision and lot of the man whose conscience, whose nesama, whose ability to reason and capacity to distinguish between right and wrong promotes, and this is off, hypothetical equivocations which inflame resentment and kindle animosity because of what he plans and plots. So God says, I'm going to do away with all this stuff. When I come back to earth, there you don't have to worry about that ugly piece of crap on top of the Temple Mount on the threshing floor between my home and Dode's home. Don't worry about that at all. Don't need to worry about the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Don't need to worry about it. I'm going to destroy them. I will completely eliminate them so they will never be seen again. And then he says, so, knowing that I'm going to incarcerate and eliminate the purveyors of religion and the artifacts of religion, then here's a word of advice. You know, if you're listening, you know, Christians are lugging this stuff around, but they don't seem to ever want to read it. You should refrain from approaching, and you should forsake, separate yourself from, refuse, disown, abandon, cease and desist any association with, staying away from the provision and lot of the man whose conscience promotes hypothetical equivocations which inflame resentment and kindle animosity because of what he plans and plots.
Wow.
Religion, politics.
Oh, come on. I thought we were supposed to coexist.
No, not according to God. There's no coexistence. And God's vocabulary, he wants the opposite of coexisting.
Yeah,
walk
I'm going to have
disassociate
to
disassociate with it. Yeah, yeah. Be set apart from these things. Don't be religious. You want to make certain that you're going to be discarded and disappear when Yahweh returns, then hang around religious people. Be part of their plots.
Kind of like a lightning rod.
Yeah. Good. Staying away from the provision.
Well, he says it right there. They're neshama. It's all screwed up. They can't tell right from wrong, good from bad, truth from a lie.
When Yahweh destroyed the humans in Mesopotamia up through the Black Sea.
Because of the neshama.
It was because they misused their neshama. They were able to use language in oral and written form, and the ability to think to create weapons of mass destruction. Religion, politics, militaries. Yeah. And God said man had become so vicious, that so hostile to life, that he just eliminated everyone with a neshama save 8 people. And those are the 8 people that listened to his instructions. And now he's using one of the most important words in this, in the whole of Yashaya thus far, and it's tied in with Nesama, is Amph. Mm-hmm. And it means equivocations which inflame resentment and kindle animosity. In addition, nevertheless, reveals displeasure over their situation and subsequently evokes and discourages misdirected anger, becoming an arrogant and enraged, wrathful, snorting blowhard, ferociously demonstrating a haughty, conceited, and contrarian countenance while promoting and harboring angst.
That sounds like Paul.
Amongst all humans. Who's the best fit for that?
Shaul.
Shaul.
Satan.
And Shaul from his first letter, Galatians, to his last letter, the second one he wrote to Timothy, or third one he wrote to Timothy, Paul was vehemently opposed to Yosha's disciples.
Mm-hmm.
He was vehemently opposed to those who were Torah observant.
Right.
And he was
opposed to circumcision.
He was
Are you kidding?
Circumcision, the sign of the covenant. He was so opposed to the original and one and only covenant that he created a new one to replace the old one.
Why do you think Paul had to escape town in a basket? Huh?
Yeah.
You don't think the Jews wanted to kill him?
Because he was anti-Torah. And, you could not find a more contrarian individual than Paul. But this is being applied to all religion. But just keep in mind that Christianity is based on Paul's letters. He wrote over half of the Christian New Testament. You can't get to Christianity without Paul's letters. There is no Christianity without Paul's letters. Nothing Yosha said gives Christianity any credence. And the only way you can get credence for Christianity based upon Yosha's testimony is to completely mistranslate, to say things, upon this rock I'll build my church, for example. Where he didn't say church. He didn't even say ecclesia, which is the word that he's translated saying. He said mikra.
Yep.
Which means his called out assemblies, of which there's 7 of them, the first 4 of which he fulfilled almost immediately thereafter. And yet, people are unaware. But it's not just Paul who displayed off. Look at Muhammad after him. Hypothetical equivocations which inflame resentment and kindle animosity. I mean, the same demonic spirit that possessed Paul went on to possess Muhammad. exactly the same rhetoric, same attitude, same approach, same contrarian, hypothetical drivel. Showing this.
And Rabbi Akiva,
yeah.
He was no
good. Rabbi Akiva. Yeah, Hadrian, Rabbi Akiva.
And every rabbi today is a perfect example of the hatred to Yahweh's Kodesh.
Yeah.
That's it.
Uh-huh.
You have to
Absolutely.
Hate him if you won't even use his name.
Right.
That's like somebody in outing somebody, you know, like an Amish and stuff, and they won't even speak their name in his house. What does that say? They can't stand them.
Right, right. Yeah, in fact, one of the ways that you show hatred of someone is you said their name shall never be spoken again in this house.
Yeah, and you scratch them off their...
What did the Pope say about Yahweh's name?
He said don't use it in
his
the...
His name cannot be used in our church.
Right. It cannot be used in any one of their churches. Right. That's how you wipe somebody
that's
out. That's
like
how you show
inviting
your disdain
your
for
wife
them.
In and saying, you know, we're not going to use your name anymore. Not in this house.
Your name.
It's like the
except for the fact that in the case
what kind of relationship
acronym
is that
they're not inviting
for
Yahweh
his name should be blotted out.
Yeah, they're not even.
Yeah.
Not
they, that's
him.
What they say. Yahusha's name was.
Yeah, Yahusha is Yeshua.
Yeshua.
The acronym
may his name be
and,
blotted out.
In Hebrew, yeah, it was rabbinic. May his name be blotted out. Yeah, exactly. Now, you all know, because I think you've all read ahead, that this is not the first time that neshama has been used, and not the first time that umph's been used. And neshama, first of all, is the thing, it's the conscience which is used to promote these hypothetical equivocations, which inflame resentment and kindle animosity that create these plans and plots. The first use of neshama was with regard to Adam. He was made uniquely like God, the ability to think rationally. He was clearly given a nefesh soul, and then Yahweh gave him a neshama so that he could think rationally. You know, that's the reason why we can't have a relationship with a dung beetle. The dung beetle can't think rationally. It has a soul, so it can observe its environment and respond to it, but it cannot think rationally. And Yahweh,
but he can sure push a ball of crap around.
same situation. The only way for him to have a relationship with us is to give us the ability to think rationally. And so, deprived of our neshama, the relationship with God would be degraded to the point that it would be akin to God trying to have an intellectual conversation about the ill effects of religion with a swarm of gnats. Good luck with that. Even God could prevail under those circumstances. So our neshama is our conscience, our ability to reason, the capacity to distinguish between right and wrong. And here, umph is promoting hypothetical equivocations which inflame resentment and kindle animosity. So, neshama, umph, is religious man, political, militant man. So, I thought it might be interesting to look at the first use of umph. It's in Bereshit 3:1, Genesis 3:1. This is what it says. Now the serpent was subtle, crafty and clever, arum, cunning, tricky, treacherous, shrewd and sly. Now, that's really interesting. So, Hasatan here is not being presented as someone who would go in and say, hey, I'm the devil.
I'm the devil, red, pointy horns, goat
right.
boobs, come on.
Yeah, this the Satan title here, that means I'm the adversary. I am adversarial. You know, no, it says exactly the opposite. The serpent, Satan, presented himself in a way that was clever and cunning and tricky. In other words, Satan pretended to be what he was not. And that's why I have so much trouble with people that don't understand that Satan is the god of religion. That Satan presents himself as what he is not. He's the lord of religion. That Satan absolutely does not want to be worshipped in an occult ceremony. So when you, when people get say, oh, you know, they were having an occult ceremony, they were having a, you know, worshipping Satan. I said, they are lost fools that that do not know Satan, that Satan does not care about.
They don't really know God. They don't even know Satan.
They don't even know the guy they're trying to worship.
You look at the pagan calendar and you look at the Christian calendar, and they're the exact same holidays.
Right. Correct.
You know?
Yeah, it's Satan using a sly trick to present himself as he is not. You know, it's here again in Yeshayah that we learn that HaSatan is wants to be seen as God, as above God, as Allahu Akbar. And so it's a shame that people can't read these words and realize that's how Satan works. He never presents himself as he is, never wants to be known as he is. He has nothing to do with the occult and Satan worship. Nothing. So now the serpent was subtle, crafty and clever, cunning, tricky and treacherous, shrewd and sly, more than all of the living creatures of the environs, which Yahweh Almighty had engaged. And he said to the woman, hypothetically, while kindling some animosity off, nevertheless, to some extent, surely and conditionally, harboring some bitterness while inflaming resentment, encouraging misdirected anger, displaying an enraged arrogance as a wrathful, snorting blowhard, ferociously demonstrating a haughty, conceited, and contrarian countenance while promoting hypothetical equivocations. Because, unto the contrary, God said, you should not eat of any and every tree of the garden. Well, that's not really what God said, is it? But what's more important here is think about this for a moment. For HaSatan to fool, to mislead Chawa into going against Yahweh's instructions, he had to kindle a little animosity. So what do you think HaSatan played upon? Where do you think that Chawa may have had some misdirected animosity? She was created second. She was created to create an opportunity for Adam to have someone he could communicate with and love and enjoy. Do you think maybe she resented the relationship Yahweh had with Adam?
Well, you try to divide and conquer, so he certainly played up to that. You know,
so there was something with Chawa that had a little resistance. It was either she had some animosity towards Adam, or she had animosity towards Joe.
Well, maybe she was a little jealous. Maybe he spent more time with him.
Well, yeah, well, maybe she
we
was
don't
spending
know,
more
but
time
I mean, that's, it's not.
We
it's
don't
not
know,
out
but
out
we're
out
told. We are told with Amph there was some animosity. You know, when I read Paul's letters, it's obvious to me that he hated God, hated him. And so he promoted Satan as God, knowingly, purposefully, deliberately. So in this particular case, we see Amph telling us that HaSatan kindled some animosity. And the animosity had to be either at Adam or at Yahweh or both. And I suspect both. She was jealous. Maybe what she wanted was an exclusive relationship. Maybe she didn't want to share Adam. Maybe she thought that, you know, in this relationship, Yahweh was had more power, and if she, you know, listened to the serpent, that she would gain that power, that insight, that intelligence, and, you know, that she would be as alluring, as interesting as Yahweh. But she had some, she clearly had issues. So it tells you she had free will. She's not a lot different than humans today. We all have our jealousies. We all have our animosities, which can be kindled. We all harbor a little bitterness here and there. We all have a little resentment, and that's what Hasatan took advantage of. I'd never really thought about that before, but because you'd say, you know, what really was Hasatan offering her?
Yeah. You had to strike a nerve somewhere.
You know, one of the things that's sort of interesting is that Yahweh created Adam for himself. He wanted a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Adam was created for himself. Yahweh was created for Adam.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's lots of places where we are told that Adam and Yahweh talked and engaged and had lively discussions. Are we ever told that Yahweh and Chawa?
Not really.
Did that?
Not in detail.
No, and certainly Yahweh never says that Chawa was created for him. They're never told that. Now, do I think that Adam and Chawa had a relationship? Yeah, probably. But the primary relationship was between Adam and Yahweh, and Chawa was created for Adam, not for Yahweh.
Yeah, it sounded like the Yosef story, didn't it?
Yeah, so it really does sound like that was where the friction was.
Mm-hmm.
Chawa wasn't created for Yahweh. She was created for Adam. And Adam was created for Yahweh. So Adam had two relationships. Yahweh had essentially one. I mean, Chawa had one, Adam had two. So there probably was the place where there was animosity. You know, it's going to be an interesting bit of enlightenment when we find all that out. But I think it shows a lot about the nature of humanity, specifically without it. And, you know, while we were tracing all of this, there's another place where off is used. And it pertains to the tree of lives. And it was something that Roy had directed my attention to. And I thought, you know, since we brought it up, you know, why not to deal with it a little bit? So I'm going to read here. This is Marshall Proverbs 11. We see the consequence of having resentment. And I think religion is conceived out of by those who have a resentment to God. He who diligently seeks that which is agreeable and good, Tob, procures information leading to acceptance and approval. Well, that's pretty straightforward. If you look to the Torah, for example, and you seek that which is presented in the Torah, which Yahweh says is good, and you procure that information and you accept it, you're going to be accepted. But he who consults with and petitions that which is evil and harmful, perverted and corrupt, ra'ah, such things will come to him. Well, that seems more than fair, too. That's Mashal 11:27. By trusting and relying in wealth, he will fail and he will fall. But like the growing and uplifted foliage that absorbs the light, the one who's right will flourish and grow, taking flight. Boy, if you're trusting in money, expect to fall just as the value of money descends, decays. But like the growing and uplifted forage, a tree is just beautiful, that the one who is right will flourish, grow, taking flight. He who brings trouble to his family, he will inherit and take possession of a spirit. Well, the Ruach, this spiritual being, in this case would be a demon aligned with Satan. And a slave to foolishness and perversity he will mock. And as a slave to foolishness and perversity he will mock the approach of the one who has the capacity to reason, the one who exercises good judgment. I've got to say that, you know, if you are amongst the religious individuals that mocks ignorantly those who approach life thoughtfully, using reason, then you've essentially become a slave to your faith. And that they will mock all of those that are driven by exercising good judgment. The fruit of being right is a tree of lives. Wow. The fruit, the results of tzedak, of being right, is a tree of lives. He's just now explained the etz chayim. And it receives and accepts souls of those with the capacity to reason and understand by being discerning, chakam. If you're open to learning and instruction, if you're intelligent and prudent, if you're receptive to open to trustworthy guidance, and if you do those things and you are willing to receive and accept those things on a right, then your soul is going to be one of those that gets to approach Yahweh. Surely, those who are right in the land will be completely compensated, recompensed. And so, again, Yahweh is making a distinction. It has nothing to do with faith. It has all to do with being right. If you look at what is good, if you consider what is good, the Torah, you'll become right. Nothing more important when it comes to God. That's why the test with Abraham is being right. Surely, those who are right will be completely recompensed, totally repaid and compensated. But indeed also those who promote hypothetical equivocations which inflame resentment and kindle animosity, umph, those who are vexing and wrong and those who bear the blame for missing the way will also be repaid for what they have done. Powerful description of umph. But isn't it interesting that the tree of lives is approachable by having the right answer? If you're right, the tree of lives.
Better than being good.
And it's called the tree of lives. It's chayim, not just chay, because of the fact that there are multiple lives. You know,
plural. It's definitely
this,
plural.
Yeah, we have this life, and we have an eternal life. The tree of lives.
And before we move on, Kirk, you took a look at the word lakha. Lamed Kof Hey. Can you tell what that means in Paleo Hebrew? It's a very beautiful word.
Spell it again. It's a lamb, a che.
Yeah, a kof Hey. Lacha.
What was the middle one?
It's
Kof.
LQH. He who receives and accepts Lacha.
Yes.
He who grabs hold of by the ham. So the lamed is?
Well, the lamed, of course, is leading. It's the same as directions and guidance.
Yeah.
And
the shepherd's staff,
of course,
right?
Uses. Uh-huh. And there's a yaw in there, too? I'm sorry.
No, it's lamed.
Just the cough.
The Q. Q.
Okay.
And the H.
Yeah, the new day, and of course the hey is a behold, someone looking up, standing upright, engaged in the walk.
Yeah, kof is perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It's ability to see the big picture, the see over the horizon, to have a long and complete perspective.
Yeah.
To see, to appreciate a new day that is dawning. So,
right.
Lakoch would be the person who is properly led by the shepherd, who has a long view, the proper perspective, who sees the big picture, if you will, is going to stand, reach up to, and behold God.
And you know, so, and you would know that it's a positive thing because the direction line's going right to left, and what's doing is nothing in between that separates Yah's leadership or Yah's Torah. See, I think of the Lamb also as like Torah, Yara, teaching, guidance, direction, so forth. So
right.
You put that
right
there, and then you go through the quaff and then down to the hay.
Yeah.
You know, that's that. Then you put it in the camp of, okay, that's positive. We know that's something nourishing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great benefit here.
Mm-hmm.
So,
exactly.
Nothing
and
deep.
So, the fruit of being right is the tree of lives.
Yeah.
And it receives and accepts those with the capacity to reason and understand. I don't know if there's a better statement in terms of understanding the nature of Eden than that.
Yeah.
The fruit, the product, the that which is produced by, the result of being right, Sadak, is the tree of lives. And then God just says, oh, let me explain it to you, that it receives and accepts the tree of lives, grasped hold of by the hands, souls of those with the capacity to reason and understand by being discerning. I mean, it completely destroys Mohammedan Islam, Pauline Christianity, Scientology, Mormonism, every faith, including faith in one's government or faith in one's military. God is saying that the fruit, the product, the results of being right is the tree of lives, and it receives and accepts souls of those with the capacity to reason and understand by being discerning. That is what we talk about.
The tree of lives, and who's the branch? Who's the branch?
Yeah, Yosha.
Yeah.
Yosha is the branch in the tree of lives. But it is a tree of lives because Yahweh gives the unthinking, who are incorrect because they are religious and political, he gives them a life. He created life. So life, one, is given to those who are wrong. It's only those who are right that get lives. Right. And, you know, even in the extreme case of the 1 in 100 individuals or so that eternally exists in the black hole of Sheol, they have but one life.
It just extended it.
That's correct.
They're still dwelling in the same horror that they came in with.
That is correct. Where we are reborn from above in Yahweh's spirit, in his light, as his children. So we're born into our human family, and then we're born into Yahweh's covenant family. We have two lives, and there is, other than our proclivities and our personalities, there's really nothing else we're taking from this life into the next one. It's a whole new ball game.
Well, even if we took something with us in the sense of memory, it's certainly these things wouldn't bother us.
Yeah, I don't know how much memory we're going to take with us. You know, I hope.
Well, how do you take? But you'd be taking your personality. There's a lot of things about your personality that would develop
They're memory based. Right.
Memory and so forth. So, I mean, that's a hard call.
Clearly, I think we're going to remember these discussions. I think we'll remember these programs, these get-togethers.
I hope so.
I think we're going to. I think we're going to remember the things we learned from Yahweh's Word, and I think we're going to celebrate those things. And we're going to remember one another that was part of the covenant family. I'm convinced that is true. It's just that there are a lot of memories that we will not take with us.
I hope not.
Just because they would be agonizing and painful.
Well, Yahweh does make a promise in Mashal where he's going to wipe away the tears of his people.
Right.
So obviously we're not going to
harbor those things or
correct.
Be troubled by
those
things, right?
Correct. indeed true. Yeah, coming to know Yah, it's the greatest blessing of all. And coming to study his testimony, to think about it, but just little things like this. I mean, the fruit of being right is the tree of lives. So when God speaks of fruit, when he speaks of the tree of lives, it's being right. So why couldn't Adam and Chawa take a bite out of the tree of lives? Because they didn't know the right answer. You know, they knew Yahweh, but to know the right answer was way beyond where they were. You got to be right. And to be right implies that there is the possibility of wrong. And so it's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, of the ability to be confronted with right and wrong, that makes a right answer material. There is no such thing as a right or wrong answer when there's only one answer. You know, there's no distinguishing between right and wrong when there's only right.
Yeah.
And so the tree of the knowledge of good and evil not only had to come before the tree of lives, because you had to be able to be in a position to choose right and to be correct over incorrect, there was no merit for a tree of lives when there was only right. Your life was eternal at that point. It was nothing but that which was wonderful. And so there was no reason for a tree of lives. You wouldn't benefit from it while you're already perfected in Yahweh's company. And being right only is material, only has merit when there is the propensity, the capability of being wrong. And so you have to be able to position, to be able to distinguish between right and wrong.
And Hashatan loves a counterfeit, right? We know that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Do you want to know what the Arabic word, speaking of counterfeits?
Right.
Aleh is the word for leaf. Comes from the root word of Allah. It means to go or be up high, like a leaf will be up high in a tree.
Yeah, the perfect counterfeit.
The other counterfeit is the other piece of wood
Yahweh
with their dead
God. Like,
Yahweh has
a tree of lives. Where did Satan want to be worshipped in the ancient world? Groves of trees. The highest mountains. Capitol Hill. Of course, Capitol Hill was a knoll in a swamp.
And have them kept
all
dying.
By a Freemason. And old George Washington, boy, they get on Trump all the time. They say, you know, he shouldn't have that hotel in Washington, D.C. It's a conflict of interest. George Washington owned the swamp that he sold to the U.S. government to create Washington, D.C., and then saw to it that it was laid out in Freemason
Masonic
fashion.
Terms.
Yeah, Masonic fashion.
What a
wicked web we weave. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I saw that show Timeless. I don't know if you guys have ever seen Timeless, but it's a TV show where they can go back in time, and their good guys are chasing bad guys. But they had a show on Benedict Arnold and George Washington. And evidently, when Benedict Arnold, who was one of George Washington's friends, turned against George Washington and in favor of the British. Now, mind you, he was a British citizen, and so it was Washington that was a revolutionary. But anyway, he was his friend, and he turned against Washington. And Washington had Washington required everyone in his presence to speak to him as Your Majesty. Now, most people, think of Washington as the humble guy
he gave up being king.
No, he was, if you were in his presence, you had to call him Your Majesty. And Benedict Arnold says, "Oh, come on, this is a fraud. You just got one king replacing another king. We're just using different terms, but Your Majesty." But you know what Washington did to Benedict Arnold's young wife? He murdered her.
Murdered?
He what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you mean that same American guy, the George Washington, the Washington Monument, where he's in a bachelor pose?
That guy? Yeah, that guy that if you wanted to be a general
cupcake.
In his army, you had to be a Freemason. That guy. That had everyone that approached him had to bow in his presence and call him Your Majesty. Yeah, and then Benedict Arnold's
and
wife.
And their America are your founding
murdered.
Fathers.
Yeah, those are your founding fathers, America. My founding father is Yahweh. He is Adam and Noah.
I guess
Noah.
You can go back, Adam or
right,
Abram.
And, right, and Moshe and Dode, and of course Abraham and Yishak and Jacob.
And Deborah.
Those are my founding
and
fathers.
Ruth.
The great
and
empowering
and
father,
and
Abraham.
And Sarai, Sarai.
Yeah. Sarai became Sarah. Absolutely, to engage and to endure. All right, well, we've reached past the time when our program is being broadcast. It's always been fun. We're got a little bit more on the bone on the Tree of Lives and Umph, which we can pick up next time, and then we'll be into chapter 8.
Until I see y'all next week, I'll study my quaff.
Okay, study your quaff. The sun on the horizon. Beginning of a new day. The long perspective. An uninterrupted perspective.
A holistic
enjoyed it.
View.
Shabbat shalom to all of you. Thank you for having
okay.
me join.
Okay, you guys next
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Good night.